They couldn't find it. And when we finally received the news that they did find it and they were gone, they were dead, my first impulse was to laugh. I remember laughing. It took me a long time to cry.
How old were you?
I was 12 years old, and I laughed. At the time, it felt like a really odd thing, and I kind of cringed with people around me. They probably think I'm really a bad person. But that was my first impulse, and you're saying it happened.
Stupid. You know, last year a book came out, The Other Side of Sadness, and it's by two researchers. Well, it's written by George Bonanno, I think is how he pronounces his name, but his fellow researcher was Dasher Keltner. And they did a two-year study of people, and they talk about it in the book, The Other Side of Sadness, two-year study of people who are grieving. And what they found is those who found some humor, started to laugh, or found some humor right after the death of their loved one, did much better over a two-year period than the people who did not find any humor. So here we think it's like not appropriate. How can you laugh at a time like that? And yet they're showing that it's so beneficial. I'm not saying that tears are not important.
Right, right.
You know, grieving is very important.
Yes.
But also, I don't think we give enough credit to finding the humor, because again, it's going to give us that perspective.
You tell a wonderful story of a woman who had lost her husband in 9/11 in the crash of the buildings, and you describe how she was filling out a missing person report. Do you recall this? And she said, oh, and she was filling in details, and then she said, oh, and by the way, he left the house this morning with the worst tie. Do you remember that?
I do.
And you know, can you describe the tie?
Do you remember?
Let's see. I can tell, because to give the visual, because I just now read it.
Yeah.
It was green tie with pink flamingos and palm trees. and she started to laugh.
Yeah.
And you really describe that as when she said something like what you had quoted her as saying in the article that you had read, that she said, well, it's all that my family and I have now.
Right, right.
Because we've lost everything.
Right,
and
you know, in my research, I've this story is like that over and over again I get from people. And I experienced it myself when I was in, a number of years ago, the major hurricane in Kauai.
Aniki,
exactly. I was scheduled to speak like a week and a half later in Kauai at a hospital. And I thought they're going to cancel. They said, no, we need it more than ever. And all of these stories that came up, I remember one story, a woman said, you know, they're telling us, get out, go shelter, go get cover. And she said to her husband's like pulling her out of the house, and she's going, no, my laundry's still in the dryer. It's not dry yet. I can't leave. How could I leave with wet clothes? And they just start laughing. I mean, the thing is, humor is all around us. But I think when we're dealing with loss and grief and we forget it, you know, but it is so beneficial.
I know for me, when I am feeling loss or feeling something very strongly, and someone just comes up to me in what I would say is prematurely and saying, oh, someday you'll look back on this and you'll feel much better, or you know, all these cliches and words of comfort. When I'm not ready to receive them, I want to feel something else, and I want to be acknowledged.
Right. Yes.
To feel, yes. To say, I am either angry or I am sad, I am depressed, I am feeling lonely, I feel lost, I feel grief, and I don't want to be moved off of that too soon.
Right.
And so,
well, my advice is you need to listen to the other person. You can't. If someone is ill in the hospital, you would like to cheer them up, but maybe they just heard some terrible diagnosis that came in. You can't go in with a joke. You go in and you chat with the person and you see how they're doing. And if laughter comes up, great. If tears come up, great. You know, I learned that as a hospice volunteer, that I couldn't go in and try to cheer things up. I just had to be there for whatever happened.
Sometimes, do you feel, maybe this is getting a little psychological, do you feel like people who want to change the mood of another like that is their own inability to be in that space themselves.
Right. They may feel very uncomfortable with that space, so they cannot just go in and be with the person. So that, you know, that's, you talk about what grief is. You know, this is part of it. Part of how do you deal with someone who is ill or dying? And my thing is, forget about the human. Just listen.
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 That's a big word, isn't it?
Yeah. This lesson struck me so much. I may have it in my other book, The Courage to Laugh. I think I do. But I was a new volunteer, San Francisco Hospice. And I was assigned one of my first patients, and I go in, and the woman's lying on the couch, and Dating Game is blasting away on the TV. And I thought, I'm a volunteer. I want to help this person, but I'm not helping. She's on the couch
and watching TV.
So I kind of lowered it, and she said, make that louder. And so I did, and then shouting, because over the TV, I said, I'm here to help you. Is there anything I can do? And she thought for a while, and she said, do you know how to dance? So I got up and I danced around the room to Dating Game music, and I sat down. I said, how do you like that? And she kind of shrugged her shoulders. I was becoming frustrated, so I kept asking her, is there anything I can do? Is there anything I can do? Long silence, and she said, you could leave. My heart sank. The family came back. I didn't tell them what happened. I went to the hospice office, told them the story, and they got hysterical. Because they said if there was a camera in the corner of the room watching dance around the room, you know, interact, trying to please this woman, how funny that was. And I started to laugh. But the big lesson this woman, I mean, every person, every patient I work with gave me some lesson. And this one was, you can't go in with your own agenda.
There you go.
Just listen to that other person. And they're the ones that are dying. You're not dying. They're the ones that are ill. What do they want?
So maybe if you had that to do all over again, how would you do it now? If you walked in the room, Dating Game is on.
Well, I may talk to her about Dating Game. Oh, did you see that? Did you like, you know what, you know, kind of in.
Sit down with
involve
her.
Involve her. Exactly.
Watching it with her.
Exactly. And then maybe saying, is there anything you need right now?
Yeah.
But not keep saying, no, I'm a volunteer. I want to help you.
I want to help you. I have a way to do it.
But thank you, whoever she was. I don't remember her name, but she gave me a great lesson.
That reminds me of another story in the book, and it was from Leo Buscaglia, when a little boy, he describes a little boy, a neighbor had some deep loss, and the neighbor was crying, and the little boy crawled into his lap. And I think the mother asked, or someone asked, well, what are you doing? And the little boy said, I'm helping him cry. That's kind of what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Is that to help them do what they're doing.
Yes, and I have a story that goes with it from my own life, which I didn't put in the book, which I just remembered as we're talking. When Ellen was dying, I went to a therapist. And after the second or third session, he told me, well, Alan, life is difficult. And I got up and I said, my wife is dying. I don't need you to tell me life is difficult. And I walked out and I got Shanti at the time. I got a volunteer from Shanti. It was an older woman who lost her husband. We sat and we cried together a lot and we laughed together a lot. Because that's the way, you know, that comforted me more than somebody telling me life is difficult.
Right.
Just being with another person who understood and listening to what I was going through was so helpful.
And then that reminds me that it's good not to isolate, although it may be difficult, that we want to pull in and not get out in the world, but it's good not to isolate when we've experienced a large loss in our life.
Right, because that's, you know, we want to kind of crawl up and die in some ways, you know, and some people do that. And one of the sections in the book, I talk about how people maybe who are grieving way too long, not that there's a limit, but, you know, for years might be way too long, that there's probably two lives lost, the person that died and the person that's still living but is not getting on with their life.
Right, yes, and you make a good point of that, that if we need to, at some point, look at Are we, as you say, a double loss? Are we just...
Right. So we need to kind of embrace the loss. It's why exactly. The five stages I have in learning to laugh, first one is losing.
I'm here with Alan Klein, and he's the author of many books. One is The Courage to Laugh, and another one is Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, Embracing Life After Loss. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available